From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the life and comedy of Lenny Bruce. We talk with filmmaker Robert Wydee about the controversial social satirist whose comedy provoked the religious and legal establishments. Wydee's new documentary, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, premiered on HBO this week. And we'll hear an excerpt of an earlier radio documentary on Lenny Bruce, an interview with his colorful mother, Sally Marr. The comedy of Lenny Bruce, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. Los Angeles District Attorney Gil Garcetti says his office will seek the death penalty for Buford Furrow. He's been charged with first-degree murder and 5 counts of attempted murder, all alleged as hate crimes. Furrow was accused of wounding 5 people at a Jewish community center in Los Angeles on Tuesday and of killing a U.S. postal worker a short time later. Officials say Furrow told the FBI he killed the postal worker because he was not white and he worked for the federal government. Attorney General Janet Reno says Tuesday's shootings underscore the need for tougher gun control laws and stronger hate crime laws, and she urged all Americans to stand together against bigotry and prejudice.
I ask you to reach out to the Jewish and Asian communities and to others who have been the victims of hate. Let us stand as one nation, united in respect for each other and united against threats to any one of us.
She said eliminating hate crimes is one of the nation's most enduring challenges. Officials in Ohio are cracking down on anti-government activists within their state. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
They call the courts oppressive. They call some traffic laws unconstitutional, and they call the federal income tax communism. They call themselves the common law movement, and they protested by setting up their own courts and sending out unofficial property liens against public officials they don't like. In 1996, Ohio legislators passed a law making that a felony, and now Larry Roten has become the first common law activist convicted under the law. He's been found guilty on 12 counts of intimidation, retaliation, and using a sham legal process. At sentencing, Roten faces the possibility of several years in prison. Common law activists insist their movement is growing, but Ohio police say this nonviolent offshoot of the militia movement is dying. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
A new website aimed at African Americans should be online by fall, BET.com. NPR's Margo Adler has more.
BET Holdings will launch the new site in November. BET Holdings operates the Black Entertainment Television Network, as well as 3 other cable channels and several magazines. The website, BET.com, will receive $35 million in backing from 4 groups. USA Networks, Inc., the American arm of Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation, Liberty Digital, and Microsoft. BET's chairman and founder, Robert Johnson, said the new site is an effort to narrow the digital divide, overcoming the lag between black and white internet usage. Johnson said BET.com would be a unique social and economic opportunity for blacks, and he said he believed it was the largest amount of money ever spent to launch a product aimed specifically at African Americans. The website will offer news, finance, entertainment, and it will also provide message services and sales items. Margo Adler, NPR News, New York.
You're listening to NPR News in Washington. Energy Secretary Bill Richardson is recommending disciplinary action against a senior official and 2 other employees at the Los Alamos Nuclear Laboratory because of failures in the China espionage investigation. He can't take direct action because the 3 work for the University of California, which manages the lab. But he says they failed to meet their responsibilities in investigating the alleged spying by scientist Wenho Li. He was allowed to keep his top-secret job for nearly 3 years after the FBI began investigating him. The former Army Chief of Staff in Yugoslavia has formed a new political movement opposed to President Slobodan Milosevic. NPR's Sarah Chase reports from Belgrade.
The diminutive, weather-beaten general was long on ideals and democratic goals, but short on precise steps to achieve them. He said Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic should be forced out of office by a vote of the federal parliament. The current chances of that are next to nothing, since Milosevic supporters dominate the parliament. pressed on his strategy for ousting Milosevic, General Perisic finally admitted a good strategy can't be revealed in advance. Perisic is seen as an important new political actor in Serbia because of the loyalty he still commands within the military. He has indicated that with him in the opposition, it would be hard to use the army against the people in case of mass demonstrations. A close advisor to the Serbian Orthodox Church has also joined the leadership of the general's movement. Sarah Chase, NPR News, Belgrade.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 1.5 points today. The Nasdaq lost 15 points, and the S&P 500 lost nearly 4 points. Trading was moderate. I'm Ann Bozell, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, in for Terry Gross. This month, HBO presents a documentary on the life and work of one of the country's most controversial stand-up comics and satirists, Lenny Bruce. Robert Wide's film, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, uses home movies, interviews, bits from TV shows and live performances, even scenes from cheesy movies that Lenny made, to create an intimate portrait of this complex man. Lenny Bruce was busted many times for drugs and obscenity, but his friends and biographers agree that what really hit a raw nerve was his take on organized religion and his satires of prominent religious leaders like Cardinal Spellman, Billy Graham, and the Pope. Before we talk to Robert Wide, let's listen to a 1958 Lenny Bruce performance. The setting is the Office of Religion Incorporated on Madison Avenue. Billy Graham, Rabbi Weiss, and other religious leaders are meeting when a call comes in from Pope John the 23rd. Oral Roberts takes the call.
Yes, operator. This is 610. Yes, I'll take the charges. Yes. Hello, Johnny. What's shaking, baby? Boy, it's really been an election month, hasn't it, sweetie? Well, listen, I hate to... Yeah, the puff of white smoke knocked me out.
Listen, I hate to bug you, but they're bugging us again with that dumb integration. Now, I don't know why the hell I'm gonna go to school either. Yeah, that school bus scene. Well, we had to give them the bus, but there's two toilets on each bus. They're bugging us. They say, get the religious leaders. Make them talk about it. I know it, but they're getting hip. Yes. They say, no, they don't want no more quotations from the Bible. They want us to come out and say things. They want us to say, let them go to school with them. No, I did walking across the water and snake into the cane. They don't want to hear that jazz anymore. And that stop war jazz every time the bombs scare. Yeah, they keep saying thou shalt not kill means that, not a man's section A. Yes. They don't want the bomb. Sure, they're commies. No, I ain't getting snotty, but we gotta do something. Yeah. I got two... Yeah, we got some people on our side. We got Scatman Crothers and Stephen Fisher. Don't do no good. No, but with the, yes, that's why I called you. What are we gonna do? Sure, that's easy for you to say. You're over there. Yeah, I know. And thanks for the pepperoni. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, did you dig Spellman on Stars of Jazz? Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay, sweetie. Yeah. You cooler, too. No, nobody knows you're Jewish.
Robert Wide, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
A lot has been said and a lot's been written about Lenny Bruce. What story, though, did you want to tell with this film?
Well, I just really wanted to tell the story of a guy who tried to speak his mind, who tried to tell the truth, who tried to keep it funny, and paid a price for it. But above all else, I just was intrigued by this guy's evolution. I mean, there's the First Amendment story, but then there's also a story of a guy who changed an entire art form, who really changed everybody who came after him, who really started off not with any intent to be a big rebel or to thwart authority, but just to get laughs. And it's interesting to watch his evolution from basically a Borscht Belt sort of comedian to somebody who is talking about sensitive issues, about government, about religion, about race, about sex, and at a time when that just wasn't done on stage.
Well, let's play a clip from your film, and perhaps I can ask you to set it up. This is from his appearance on the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scout show. This goes back to 1950, and was when he really gets his first break. Was Arthur Godfrey the kind of Johnny Carson of his day?
Yeah, but I was going to say more powerful, although I guess that's all relative. But basically, the Godfrey show was a show that if you appeared on and you made a bit and you were a big hit, you had a career. And that was really what broke for Lenny, broke it for Lenny. He was in the Navy. When he got out of the Navy, he really was bitten by the showbiz bug. His mother, Sally, was a comedian and a stage mother, and she encouraged him. And basically, the excerpt we're going to hear was part of an act that she was doing. Basically, she gave Lenny her act and helped him with his material and his delivery. And your listeners will hear that he started off doing basically what every other comic was doing at the time, impressions and mimicry and funny voices and funny accents. And it was long before he learned how to talk dirty and influence people.
Well, let's listen.
Well, you know, we're not the only country that have impersonators. As a GI overseas, I spent a great deal of time in Bavarian vaudeville houses. And the act that I got the biggest kick out of was the impersonator of the various Hollywood stars. This was all in his native tongue. The Bavarian mimic. Stop the music. Welcome, you lucky fraugers. And good ladies, evening and germs. Myself is an impersonator. Das ist Friedman, the first impersonation mit Hollywood is that of the gangster, Mr. Javier Cagney. Moritz Schmeiger, das war mein Frieden, die Frage. Das war mein Schmecken, die Frage, Frage, no belt. Hump von Bogart. All right, Träger, drop the Schmecken.
And that's Lenny Bruce performing on the Arthur Godfrey Talent Scout program back in 1950, and it's featured in my guest's film, Robert Whitey's film. It's called Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth. As much as you see all that shtick and impersonations, you do see a guy that looks very comfortable and very confident.
Yeah, well, he had watched a lot of other comedians, and he did have some sort of showbiz panache and polish, although his mother does say at that time, basically, every night before he went on stage in front of an audience, he'd be throwing up backstage. So he was nervous. He did have butterflies. But basically, he came out and was able to do his show. As time went on, he sort of became known for being very mellow and very relaxed on stage. And that was, in some way, part of his contribution to the evolution of stand-up comedy, in that instead of having his 40 minutes of prepared material and jokes and one-liners, that he really just came out and talked to the audience as though he was talking to a friend. And Lenny was the first guy who really went up on stage and just continued to talk to the audience as though he were talking to his pals at the table. It was sort of an unheard way of doing stand-up.
Once he got his break on the Arthur Godfrey show, what kinds of gigs, what kind of clubs did that lead to?
Little vaudeville gigs. He toured around the Eastern Seaboard. I think he even had a couple of gigs in the Catskill area. That sort of thing. And so he was able to make a living. He was able to play these vaudeville houses. What happened was he was playing a gig in Baltimore at a club called the Club Charles, and he met his future wife, who was a stripper, who worked under the name of Hot Honey Harlow. And she was hot. She was really something. And he fell in love. That was his shiksa goddess. And they married and then moved out to California, where Lenny's estranged father lived in Arcadia. He actually came out to Los Angeles to write movies. In fact, Buddy Hackett was a good friend of his, and Buddy lined up a gig for him writing this little kiddie science fiction film called The Rocket Man for, I think it was Fox. And but the movie work didn't really pan out. So what happened was he started playing places in the L.A. area and in the valley that were basically strip joints and dives, toilets, they called them back then. And that was sort of the next phase of his evolution because he was introducing strippers on stage. He was emceeing these shows. And if you came out and did jokes about, you know, your mother-in-law or your wife's cooking or your income taxes or lady drivers, you'd get a beer bottle thrown at your head. So he did the kind of material that, you know, the drunks in those places wanted to hear.
You have an interview with his mother, the I guess we could call her the legendary Sally Marr.
Yeah,
and the first time I saw it, it was so hilarious because you're interviewing her in a beauty shop. She's literally having her hair done.
Yeah.
And I just had to ask, whose idea was that?
Oh, that was her idea. Sally was really something, and I really miss her a lot. Yeah. She died in December of 97. She was just prior to her 91st birthday. Your viewers, your listeners who see the show will be shocked to know that she was 80 when I filmed that interview with her. Now, the film took me 12 years to make, and that interview was shot back in 1987, and she was already 80. And she was just as sprightly and lucid and funny and irreverent and cantankerous as possible. She really became my surrogate grandmother. We became very, very close.
Well, she said an interesting thing about her son, Lenny Bruce, saying that he was like a buddy of mine, that she really treated him more like a pal, perhaps, than a son.
Yeah, and other people who witnessed that relationship vouch for that. They say that, first of all, she was 18 when he was born, so they're about as close in age as a mother and son could be. And people said that their dynamic was much more like a couple of buddies than mother and son. I'll give you one example, too, of how he used to kid with her, and I'll clean this up, I guess, as much as I have to for the air. But he was playing a gig, I want to say somewhere in Northern California, I guess it was, and I have a copy of a letter that he wrote to his mother saying, you know, Mom, doing this gig up here, and it's going pretty well. But, you know, I just was told by my accountant that I owe a lot of back taxes, so things are kind of tough financially. And he said, you know, there's a cat house up here that I was visiting. And they said, you know, they're always looking for more girls to bring in. And even though, you know, you're not a spring chicken anymore, they said that so long as you have a nice rear end on you, they could use you. So why don't you come up and then you can help out financially and, you know, we can get some bills paid. And this was the kind of letter that he just jot off to her. And it was a little raunchier than I just paraphrased it. But and she would get it and she would be laughing. She would be in hysterics. So that's the kind of rapport that they had. And so I really think, and other people have agreed that the key to understanding Lenny in some ways is knowing Sally. And Sally instilled a lot of thoughts and philosophy in his head as a kid, which later came out in his work.
She seemed really proud of him.
She was. Well, you know, he was her son, and she was a Jewish mother. So, of course, her son was a genius. And it's interesting, too, because, you know, then she lost her son years later and watched him go through this terrible ordeal. And hanging out with Sally, you could talk about Lenny, and she would just tell you funny anecdotes, and she'd be laughing and carrying on and telling you the greatest stories, and you'd be laughing. But then after a while, when it got quiet, you'd look at her, and very often her eyes were welled up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, all these years later, the fact that she had lost her only boy still certainly had its impact on her.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we're going to take a short break. And our guest today on Fresh Air is Robert Wiedy, and his film Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, is being featured this month on HBO. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is filmmaker Robert Wiedy. We're talking about his documentary of Lenny Bruce called Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth. Lenny Bruce was a regular on the Steve Allen Show. Why was Steve Allen so supportive of him? And he clearly was very enthusiastic.
Oh, he was a big champion. And you have to realize, well, it's a bit of a misnomer to say he was a regular because he only appeared three times, twice in 1959 and once in 1964, an appearance which was censored and shelved and ultimately lost, but uncovered for our film, thankfully. But yeah, Steve was a big champion of Lenny's, and this was at a time when Lenny already had this reputation of being uncontrollable and being irreverent and being scatological, and the idea of him doing television was sort of out of the question. But Steve championed and championed Lenny and told the network he wanted him on, and Steve had the power at that time that he could basically put on a show whoever he wanted.
Your film does feature a bit that he did that the censors did yank. And first of all, I'm curious where you found this. Where was this hidden?
Well, it's interesting because this was sort of always the holy grail for Lenny Bruce aficionados. This was the 1964 appearance, which was lost. And Steve Allen, in his book Funny People, has a chapter on Lenny. He talks about this appearance, and he talks about it being shelved and lost, and bemoans the fact that it will never be seen. Well, I found it at the UCLA Film Archives, who have a lot of Steve Allen stuff on deposit, some on videotape, some on kinescope. And basically, I was going through their records and came across this card indicating that there was a Lenny Bruce appearance from 1964. And I brought it up to Dan Einstein, one of the fellows at the archive, and I said, is this accurate? And he said, yeah. And he was familiar with the piece. I don't know if that he had screened it or viewed it. But I said, well, if this is true, this is a lost episode that never aired. And they weren't aware of that at the archives. And they put it up for me, and I screened it. And sure enough, there it was, much as Steve Allen had described it in his book. So I had the pleasure of calling up Steve Allen and telling him I'd found the missing appearance.
Well, let's play that clip. And this is Lenny Bruce in 1964, an appearance on the Steve Allen Show, an appearance that was censored.
Now, as far as the present litigation I'm involved with, I'd like to perhaps give you a four-letter word that starts with an S and ends with a T. First time on television, I'm not going to look at you when I say this, because this way I can't get busted. You don't know who said it. The band said it. Starts with an S and ends with a T, and the word is snot. I know a lot of people are thinking out there now. See, it's clever up to a point, but just for a cheap laugh, he just say snot. Supposing I could tell you something about snot that is so unique that you say, is that the truth about snot? What a fool I've been. I can't believe that all these years. Is that really, is that documented? Yes, that's the truth about snot. Well, hear this about snot. You can't get snot over a suede jacket.
And that's Lenny Bruce from an appearance on the Steve Allen Show that never saw the light of day. Well, and Lenny Bruce is very coy about this because he sets it up as the four-letter word that begins with S and ends with T.
Yeah. And
being
then
very playful about it.
Right, right. And Steve Allen fought for it and even went back and filmed this introduction to the piece warning people that Lenny was going to say a word that many of them would probably find offensive. And if they wanted to, they should change their channels right now and come back in 10 minutes. And so Steve sort of filmed this after the fact, and they cut it in to see if that would work as a disclaimer. And they still decided it was just too much for audiences of 1964 to bear. I guess they thought it would be the end of civilization or something. So they shelved it.
When did he become known as the sick comic, and who called him that?
Gee, that's a good question. I don't know who's credited with actually first coming up with that. But I think Lenny's reputation for sick comedy really started in the mid and late 50s. Again, he was working these little dives in L.A. in the early and mid 50s. And then what happened was he went up and played an extended gig at a place called Ann's 440 in the North Beach district of San Francisco. And he was up there for a long time and really kind of developed up there. And oddly enough, was championed by two very powerful critics at the time. Was Herb Cain and Ralph Gleason, who was a music critic, a jazz critic, who really dug Lenny. And the two of them started to write about Lenny. So that was sort of the next phase of his evolution. Anyway, then he came back down to Los Angeles and was playing better clubs. He was playing the Crescendo in Los Angeles on the Strip and places like that. And again, his reputation just grew and grew. He never reached the mass acceptance level of someone like a Shelley Berman or Nichols and May. He always remained at somewhat cult status, but his cult was very devoted and large enough.
He's been quoted as saying, "I am not a comic, I am Lenny Bruce." What was he trying to say by that? Was he trying to distance himself from comedy?
Well, I think that was in the later years. You know, that's really the quote that Paul Krasner gives us. Paul Krasner was a good friend of his. Paul's still around, a comedian certainly in his own right, and a political satirist. And Paul was the editor of The Realist, which was an underground sort of counterculture magazine, which actually still comes out. And Paul edited Lenny's autobiography, How to Talk Dirty and Influence People. And but when Paul was interviewing Lenny for The Realist, he asked him what the role of a comedian was. And Lenny didn't give any philosophical answer with deep social meaning. He said the obligation of a comedian is to get a laugh every 15 or 25 seconds because you're working for a club owner who has to sell seats and sell drinks, and that's your obligation, is to get laughs. That's what a comedian does. So years later, when Lenny got very serious on stage and was talking a lot about his legal problems, and sometimes the laughs were few and far between, Krasner said to him backstage one night, he said, "Well, what happened to your theory about what a comedian does, getting laughs every 15 to 25 seconds?" And Lenny said, "Well, you know, I'm not a comedian. I'm Lenny Bruce." Hmm. And it was just his observation of what he was becoming at that time, that he was becoming an icon. He was becoming a symbol. And at that point, a lot of times people would show up at his shows not to hear brilliant comedy, but to see if he would get arrested, to see if they could see a part of history and go home and tell their friends that they saw Lenny Bruce get busted.
Robert Wydie's documentary on Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, is showing this month on HBO. He'll be back in the second half of the show. And we'll hear an interview with Lenny's mother, Sally Marr. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
All Broadway musicals sound the same, especially the baritones.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Don. Say, Bill, what's that, Freddy? I've never, never been in love. Do you know something? I've never been in love either. How do you know when you're really in love? I don't know. Well, it's a certain intangible thing, my friend, you see. I've never been in love before. I never knew the score.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Vizix, laser vision correction, helping more than 1,000 people each day to reduce or eliminate their need for glasses and contacts. On the web at visx.com. From Bantam Books, publishers of Darkness Peering by Alice Blanchard, a psychological thriller debut, available in hardcover. And from Time Magazine, this week Time examines the Blair Witch Project, this summer's sleeper film, and gets reactions from the people of Burkittsville, Maryland, where it was set. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we hear a 1989 radio interview with Lenny Bruce's mother, Sally Marr. Lenny often did his routine in burlesque houses, but it was his mother who first took him to one when he was just a kid. And we hear more about Lenny Bruce from documentary filmmaker Robert Wydie.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Today we are talking about comedian and social satirist Lenny Bruce. Later on the show, we'll continue our interview with Robert Wydee, whose documentary, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, is showing on HBO this month. Wydee said the key to understanding Lenny was knowing his mother. Sally Marr, a single mom and a comedian who worked clubs and burlesque joints, introduced her only child to showbiz. She died in 1997 at the age of 90. In 1989, radio producer Larry Josephson interviewed Sally Marr in her apartment for his documentary, Lenny Bruce Remembered. It was featured on Josephson's weekly program, Modern Times. Here's an excerpt of their conversation.
How did Lenny go from doing pretty much the same kind of impressions that other comics were doing, to someone who really skewered and challenged society? He was called a sick comic. He was called an angry comic. To me, he seems like a very sweet man.
Oh, yeah.
Well, so I think he got that from you.
Am I sweet?
Yeah.
Lenny's very easy. Was very easygoing, good-natured. Never got excited. Never got angry. Didn't like anger, didn't like people who were angry. He would always run away from people who were angry. He always wanted to see things nice. Now, when he hung around New York and he did a few shows, the agents always wanted him to do his impressions, and he would tell jokes. So he went up to Montreal to work, and I didn't know that he was taking my material and doing it up there, because when I went up there, I said to the guy, the man said to me, hey, listen, he said, there was a fella here last week, Lenny Bruce, and he did all this material. Oh, I said, don't worry, I'll take care of him. So I went home. I said, Lenny, I said, you're doing my material all over the place. I said, you can't do that. Nothing to do with me. I said, it's you. I said, if you are going to do this, I said, try to create like I do. He said, well, I can't do that. I said, yes, you can. He said, I don't know. I said, look. Are there a lot of things you don't like? Say it. Do it. Don't tell it like it should be. Tell it like it is. And when you tell it like it is, people won't like it. I said, I have those problems. At that time, I was doing mothers taking their children to dancing school. And the mothers who come in and said, oh, meet my daughter, isn't she wonderful? Well, at $5 a lesson, stop the music, I'll dance myself. And I made fun of everybody. Move back there, you'll be more comfortable. And all it was observations of what was going on in the world. Now, I grew up making fun of people as a child, and people used to laugh all the time. But nobody said, you can't do that. You know what I mean? Well, I didn't have much competition. I went to the third grade, so I didn't know whether it was to take a test or...
Lenny went to the eighth grade, right?
Yeah, we're both highly educated people with opinions, right?
You lived alone with Lenny, right? You had divorced his father.
Well, his father wanted to marry a babysitter, and he did me a big favor. Yeah, Lenny was about 7.
And Lenny was attached to his father?
No, his father really didn't like him at all. But he was afraid, I don't know, he was looking for his approval. I think all boys would do that. But I had a wonderful friend, and that was my mother-in-law. But the rest of the family was snobby, and Lenny never got to meet any of his cousins, you know. Or he wasn't part of any family, Lenny. He was part of my family, you know, but not part of theirs. But Lenny had a good time with his mother. He took all my friends. I never had any... His friends were my friends. It was a very unusual relationship.
Yeah, most Jewish boys I know, including this one, are trying to put distance between themselves and their mothers. You know, it's like too much, and it's very unusual for you and Lenny to be so tight.
Don't you know, because he had such freedom. But so free, you have no idea. There's nobody in this world that have had that kind of a mother. The freedom.
Were you able to talk to him about sex in your household when he was like a teenager? Was it like free? Did you have men visiting you when
he was there?
Uh-huh.
No. If I had a boyfriend, they never stayed overnight. And it was always like, took me out. You know what I mean? But there was no hanging out and hanging around. And Lenny once wrote in a book, he said, I never saw my mother in bed with anybody but my father. And it took me years to catch on to that, because I guess a lot of mothers, a lot of kids, he said, I never had uncles. No, I tell you, when he was 11 years old, I took him to burlesque. And from what I understand, that was very weird or unusual in the 30s, right? So I'm going into the burlesque theater, and the guy said, where are you going? You can't take that kid. I said, why? Well, he said, it's dirty. I said, what are you doing? Well, why are you working here if it's dirty? Anyway, when we went in and sat down, Lenny was going on 12, I said, aren't those women beautiful? That's where he got, I don't know if you ever listened to his routines when he talked about women's breasts. If it's beautiful, it's bad. If it's maimed, you can look at it. And I was the one at that time, and he never forgot. I said, you know, I hear something about people, Lenny. I said, if that woman was in an accident, they'd say, oh, you poor thing, and everybody would try to help her, and they wouldn't even notice her bust. That's the kind of an observer I was. I said, but the fact that they're gorgeous and they're beautiful and they could possibly excite somebody, it's bad. But he said, why? I said, I wish I knew. I said, you don't see me talking to you and telling you it's bad and it's dirty. Did I ever tell you that? He said, oh, no, Mom. When Lenny joined the Navy, he wrote me a letter. He said, why do I know more than anybody else about everything, Ma? Especially about sex and gay people. He was brought up in a gay boarding house. I brought him up in a gay boarding house. And when a woman says to me, well, what are you doing? She said, don't you realize those people are queer where you live? I says, but I don't know what that means. So she says, well, that means he could grow up to be a queer. Oh, I said, no problem. I said, I was always a skinny kid. I said, I got dresses size 6, 7. And if he stays slim, I said, he can wear them. I always resented people that talked to me that way. You know, or how come you're talking to those black people? See, Lenny was brought up different than any other child.
How did he feel about his Jewishness?
Oh, he loved the idea of being Jewish. That's why he wrote Ridges Incorporated. Because I was really against it. I was really against the Jewishness, because I was brought up in an extremely Jewish home. And for some reason, I thought that he should be bar mitzvah, because I loved my father. My father passed away, and I thought, if my father were alive, he would like to have seen his grandson bar mitzvah. That was running through my head. So I took him to this shul. And I told the man, I said, I don't have any money. I said, I'm working as a housekeeper for some people. I said, how much does it cost? He said, $250. I said, well, I don't have that kind of money. He said, well, if you don't have that kind of money, what can I tell you? If you don't have the money, there's no bar mitzvah. And I really laid it on to Lenny. I said, if you ever grow up and you ever think there's a religion, that's the only thing I ever told you, Lenny. I never butt into your life. I want you to be a free thinker. I don't want you to be influenced by anybody but yourself. I said, I have to tell you something about religion. It could be bought. If I had $250, I could have bought you a bar mitzvah. But he's the one that wanted it, because a friend of his, some kid he knew, had a party. And he liked the idea of all the presents and everything. And Lenny never had a birthday party. Too busy going from one house to another. And that's how it started.
250 is probably like 10,000 now, right?
Yeah. And that was depression. But that's what really started Lenny's thinking. I think everything that happened in Lenny's very, very young life, because you can't write about anything that you don't know anything about. It's impossible. That's why you give a comedian material. He can't be a comedian. A comedian is a comedian. He views things differently. He is different than the average person.
Sally Marr, Lenny Bruce's mother, speaking with Larry Josephson in an excerpt from his 1989 radio documentary, Lenny Bruce Remembered. Coming up, we continue our interview with filmmaker Robert Wydie. His documentary on Lenny is being featured this month on HBO. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to filmmaker Robert Wydee. We're talking about his new documentary, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, which runs this month on HBO. You also say in this film that apart from his language, that it was his attacks of the church that got him in equal amounts of trouble. What did he not like about the church?
Well, the point is made in our film that there were a number of other comedians working at the time who were working in far more scatological terms than Lenny, but it tended to be more of the nudge-nudge kind of humor, two guys walk into a bar or farmer's daughter type material, and nobody bothered them because they weren't stepping on anyone's toes. Lenny upset a few people. What's interesting about the religion thing, and I should say this, that when he was busted in Chicago, after his performance one night, a cop came into the club and talked to the owner and said, if you let him on stage tonight, mock my Pope the way he did last night, we're going to clip him, we're going to clip you and everyone in the joint. And he was a good, honest cop. He was true to his word. The next night, Lenny went on stage, talked about the Pope, and he was arrested. And I'll also add this, just because it's sort of interesting anecdotally, that during his trial, coincidentally, Ash Wednesday happened to fall on one of the days of his trial, and Lenny was in court, and in walked the judge with a spot of ash on his forehead. The DA had a spot of ash on his forehead. The bailiff had ash on his forehead. And then the jurors all walked in with ash on their forehead. So this was the fair trial that he got in Chicago. But, you know, he really had nothing against God. He had nothing against people who believed in God. What he spoke out against was the hypocritical things that many people do in the name of God. He really had no problem with the idea of religion. But he was asking serious questions that were on his mind. And I'll give you an example.
Go ahead.
There's a routine which is excerpted in my documentary where he fantasizes about Christ and Moses coming back down to earth. And they decide they're going to take in, the sermon at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. So they're standing in back of the church, and Cardinal Spellman is talking about love and peace and forgiveness. And Lenny says that Christ is confused because their route took them through Spanish Harlem. And Christ is wondering why 40 Puerto Ricans are living in one room when a square foot on that stained glass window is worth $10,000. So by today's standards, that's a fairly innocuous sort of routine. I mean, you could do that on network television now, and you might get a couple of letters, but that would be it. But what's interesting, to make this point further, is that a couple of years later, Lenny would refer back to that bit, and he'd say, you know, I used to do this routine about Christ and Moses, and he'd recount the bit. And then he'd say, you know, but then I gave it some thought, and if the purpose of the church is to teach, well, you have to bring people in to teach them. You have to bring your flock in. And he says, if I'm a raggedy-ass guy living in a raggedy-ass house in a raggedy-ass part of town, why would I want to go to a raggedy-ass church? So he came to that conclusion. He realized that the splendor and the majesty of the church was to provide an attractive environment to bring people in. And once he came to that conclusion, he never went back and did the old bit. So this is hardly a rebel who's out to, you know, overthrow organized religion or overthrow the government. This was a guy who just had questions on his mind, was asking them on stage and trying to keep it funny.
What point in his career did Lenny Bruce turn some of his attention to more political issues? And I'm thinking of things like the Vietnam War, civil rights.
Yeah, that would be, early, mid-60s. He wasn't so much political by nature. Eventually, he started to do political material, and he did talk about Vietnam and what he thought we were doing there. And he did talk about political leaders, be it Eisenhower, Nixon, even Kennedy and LBJ. He was more socially oriented, talking about relationships and that sort of thing. But again, you know, it really was whatever was on his mind that day he would talk about. And if there was some big political, you know, event in the news, he'd get up and talk about it. But basically, you know, his social and political awareness really bloomed, I'd say, around 1959 and continued, you know, through to the end.
We actually have a clip from a performance at Berkeley. This is, I believe, 1964, where he's talking about LBJ. Mm-hmm. Let's listen.
Lyndon Johnson, they didn't let him talk for the first 6 months. It took him 6 months to learn how to say Negro. Negro. All right. Okay, Let's hear it one more time, Linda, now. Okay. All right, let him pose again, okay. Okay. Nigara. Oh. Now, can you say, look, is it say it quick, Negro. Okay. Nigga, oh, Negro. I can't help it, I can't say it, that's all. I can't say Negro, I'm pissing in bed and everything, and stuttering. I can't, what the hell, Negro. Let me show my scar. No. Just say it, and that's it. Yeah. He's completely confused. Well, there we go. That family is so... It's really... you know, there's a certain kind of non-Jewish look that they could pass any test. They are the biggest non-Jews in the world. No question, they walk right through the line, bap, bap.
And that's Lenny Bruce in Berkeley back in 1964. How do you think Lenny Bruce's being Jewish played into his humor? I mean, there's a whole tradition there, but how did he do it?
Well, I mean, you know, out of that Jewish tradition of making humor out of pain in life, I guess that would be the most obvious example. His mother, in some ways, was a very typical Jewish mother. In some ways, I guess she was the antithesis of a Jewish mother. But he certainly had Judaism instilled in him culturally, if not, you know, in an observant form. He used to do bits about, he felt that he was just on kind of the tail end of anti-Semitism, that he paid, you know, a certain percentage of those dues, but he talked about the different phases of being Jewish, and he talked about how you go through that defensive period where somebody says to you, "What time is it?" And you say, "Yeah, I'm Jewish, so what?" and he talked about very Jewish notions. I think his whole way of working was somewhat Talmudic, in that some people have said what he really was a funny rabbi. Oh. And of course, Jews always question. What's the old joke? You put two Jews together, you're going to get three opinions. And so Lenny was always just dissecting things and asking questions. And what he sort of ran up against was the mentality that you are not to question, which is, you know, more of the Catholic sort of thinking, which I don't say pejoratively, but that was sort of the conflict. Was here was a guy on stage questioning everything, and he was told not to question, and I think that was the big conflict.
More about Lenny Bruce after this break. My guest is documentary filmmaker Robert Wydie. This is Fresh Air. With filmmaker Robert Wydie, his documentary, Swear to Tell the Truth, is about the life and comedy of Lenny Bruce. How many times did he get arrested?
My best count is 12, about a dozen times. There's actually, that doesn't count, an early arrest for impersonating a priest. Back in Miami, he was soliciting donations for some bogus charity that he put together. That was a whole other thing. But the bus started in 1961. The last big one was in New York in 64. And from 61 to 64, between the obscenity bus and the drug bus, there were about a dozen.
And did he ever spend time in jail? Did he ever have to pay a fine?
Well, he had to pay a lot of lawyer's fees, which, you know, most people can tell you is, you know, it's about six of one, half dozen of the other. No, he never did time, although there were periods of time that he'd be put in holding cells where he'd be arrested. He'd he'd be brought to headquarters, as they used to say in 40s movies, and he'd be held in a cell overnight. That happened in New York after the arrest at the Cafe Agogo. He was brought downtown and put in a cell until the next morning.
He used a lot of the arrest material in his act at times. Even later on, he read from all sorts of police descriptions of what happened, from court transcripts as well. Did he embrace this idea of being arrested? Was that sort of part of what he wanted to do anyway?
No. It was a pain in the neck for him, and it was breaking him financially. I mean, at his peak, he was making a pretty solid six figures a year. And what happened once the arrests really started to escalate, and it really did start to snowball to Kafkaesque proportions, he couldn't get work. He couldn't get work because what they would do is they would also arrest the club owner, or they would take away their liquor license or shut them down. So club owners weren't going to take the risk of hiring him. So work dried up. He wasn't making any money. What money he did make was going to his lawyers. And these were just ridiculous cases where he had to fly all over the country and defend himself. He would have, you know, two or three court cases going on at a time. So, no, he did not enjoy it. I think after the first obscenity arrest in San Francisco, he was acquitted on that charge. And at that point, I think he probably felt, okay, I'm cool. You know, I've been acquitted in San Francisco. That sort of sets a precedent under equal protection. You know, I should be safe anywhere in the country. And soon after, he was arrested in Los Angeles in 1962 for saying the word schmuck on stage, which really, you know, gives you an idea of how silly this became. And he was acquitted in Los Angeles, but then he was arrested in Chicago. And he was found guilty in Chicago, and that was sort of the turning point. Then it really got ugly. And then the New York conviction was really the final nail in his professional coffin. It was very sad.
It is sad, though, to see Lenny Bruce's decline, and you begin to see the humor turn to rage, turn to a guy feeling sorry for himself, and you see it in his face. It's a sad commentary.
Yeah, it takes a physical toll, and again, I'm the first one to say that there are two things going on at the same time. There was this really needless legal harassment he was going through, you know, cops showing up at his house and Lenny saying, "Can I see your search warrant?" and the cops bringing out a gun and saying, "Here's my search warrant," and that kind of nonsense. A lot of busts that were clearly setups. A lot of the drug busts. I certainly have evidence to indicate that, you know, Lenny was set up on a lot of these. So there was legal harassment. They really wanted to shut this guy up. And at the same time, Lenny did have this Achilles heel of his drug use, and that took its toll too. I think the two were somewhat related. I think as not to justify it, but I think as the harassment escalated, the drug use escalated as well. I think he was trying to find a way to tune it all out. But yeah, it all did take a toll. And again, his finances just went down the tubes, and the money went to the lawyers, and he couldn't work. And it took a very definite toll, finally ending with his death at the age of 40 in 1966 from a drug overdose.
That's right. He died of a drug overdose. Who found him?
A buddy of his who's become a friend of mine, a dear guy who lives in Northern California, named John Judnick. And John initially came to the house to work as Lenny's handyman and also a sound technician, and recorded a lot of his gigs. And he lived at the house and came home and was calling, Lenny, it's John. Couldn't find him, walked around the house and then found him lying on the floor in the bathroom.
When the police came to the house, they actually posed his body. They pulled his pants down.
Yeah. You want to talk about obscene, I'll give you the
really?
Ultimate obscenity. Because when John found him, he was, you know, Lenny had fallen on the floor off of the toilet. But John, out of respect for Lenny, knowing that people ultimately were going to be showing up at the house, put Lenny's pants on him and, you know, buckled him up, called one of Lenny's attorneys, who then, I guess, called, I don't know if he called the cops or if he called the press, but eventually the cops and the press both showed up. And the cops were letting reporters and photographers in two by two, sort of like at a deli counter when you take the number and they call your number and you get to go in. So the photographers were going in two by two, but they couldn't get a good shot of Lenny at the angle he was in. So the police sort of posed him. They pulled him out of the bathroom so the photographers could get a better shot at him, and then they pulled his pants off. They removed his pants. And the photographs and the news footage you see of Lenny at the end are basically, you know, it was a photo op. It was the final photo op. And I think it was the cops' way of saying, look, this is what happens when you take us on.
When would you say Lenny Bruce reached his peak? At what point in his life, his career?
I would say his peak years were from 57 through maybe 61. I'd say the top of the mountain for him was his performance at Carnegie Hall in February of 61. And as your listeners will see if they watch the show, is this took place in the middle of a devastating blizzard in New York City, where public transportation came to a halt, even, you know, personal transportation. There's no way to drive through the city. They were just snowed in. And Lenny played Carnegie Hall at midnight, a midnight show in this blizzard, and sold the place out. And that concert actually exists on CD, unabridged, and it's a wonderful, wonderful concert. And you're really hearing Lenny just, you know, swing with the best of them.
Robert Wydee's documentary, Lenny Bruce, Swear to Tell the Truth, airs this month on HBO.
Dick, he is so strange. Not the people necessarily involved with the religion, but the religion itself, Catholicism, a genius religion. 3 years ago, I was wondering, I used to do a bit, you know, 4 years ago, Religions Incorporated. So my view at that time was, here's a rich church, Catholicism, next door is poverty, so it's hypocrisy. So, obvious view. So I started digging, reading, getting into it. Then I realized the reason for the Baroque church, the grand church in the poverty neighborhood, is that what the church is a school. It's a method of instruction. And people who have no understanding, who need instruction, don't know about philosophy. They can only understand material things. So a raggedy-ass guy won't go into a raggedy-ass temple. He said, I'm living in a shit house. What I got to go in one for? But if you show him something nice he can understand, then you can instruct him. Okay. So the Ecumenical Council really are geniuses, and they make some tremendous moves.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Bob Pertig is our engineer. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Thanks to Larry Josephson and the Radio Foundation, KCRW and WNYC, for the excerpt of Larry's interview with Sally Marr, which was recorded for his 1989 documentary, Lenny Bruce Remembered. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Queen Mother's Century by Robert Lacey, a book of photographs in bookstores everywhere. From the National Endowment for the Humanities, expanding American understanding of human experience and culture. And from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Life of Birds by David Attenborough, a companion to the 10-part TV series airing now on PBS. In bookstores or on the web at pup.princeton.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, for the 100th anniversary of Alfred Hitchcock's birth, we hear from actress Janet Leigh, who starred in Psycho, and screenwriter Evan Hunter, who wrote the screenplay for The Birds. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Join us for the next Fresh Air.